Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's awesome.
Chad Dawson was upset.
as well as Sam Solomon being upset by Jermaine Taylor.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw that fight. Sam Solomon's leg went in the seventh round, and that was it. He was literally fighting on one leg from that point on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And there were four knockdowns suffered by Solomon, but all those knockdowns, from what I could see, could have been attributed to his leg, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sam Solomon's 40 years old. And to be honest, before he hurt his leg, he looked pretty nimble and spry for 40. He's not the cleanest of guys, but he's a very, very crafty guy, knows how to use his feet well, gets in and out, and he's more of a spoiler to a certain point.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
A spoiler. He'll spoil your game plan.
Yeah.
Jermaine Taylor didn't look good to me at all. I'm going to be honest, totally honest. He looked technically worse. He looked strong, but Jermaine Taylor always has been a strong fighter. You know, everybody he's fought against, he's been a strong. You can't say that anybody's been significantly stronger than him.
And you know what, Zito? I'll even add to that point and say that if you look at everyone he's been in the ring with, he's typically been as strong, if not stronger, than most of his opponents, as well as faster too, of hand and foot.
Exactly. And the thing is, he's been faster, but, and with Jermaine Taylor, it's a but. He has a pretty good jab. He telegraphs it at certain times, but he has a pretty good jab. His right hand is terrible, if anything. It wasn't technically sound before, but he lifts his elbow up and then throws the punch. So he's almost stabbing you with it. And it's gotten a lot worse. I mean, he lifts his elbow up high before he throws the punch. He telegraphs it. And even with a hurt leg, Sam Solomon was able to avoid that most of the time just because he telegraphed it so much. Jermaine Taylor, his reflexes look shot.
Yeah.
His feet, he doesn't bend at his knees anymore. He's stiff. And he's never been a defensive guy, but he's been – athletic enough to get away from certain attacks. Jermaine Taylor at this point, oh my goodness, if Bernard Hopkins at this point, their careers seem to have just gone two different ways since they fought each other, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I completely concur. I watched the fight, and honestly, I thought Solomon was on his way to winning the fight. Until he hurt his leg. It was close and it was competitive. He wasn't dominating. Kind of like Zito was saying, Solomon doesn't have the cleanest technique. What he is he's a high work guy. He's a high volume guy who knows how to get in and be rough and outwork you and grab you when he has to and move his feet when he has to. And he's just very hard to get a beat on, and he stays busy. But I saw the same thing Zito saw. I didn't think Jermaine Taylor looked great, and part of the reason why, and I think Zito alluded to this, is Jermaine Taylor was a guy who was gifted with marvelous athleticism. Again, he was just a physically strong, very quick athletic fighter. So now we're looking at a 36-year-old Jermaine Taylor, who was never the most technically astute in spite of his amateur pedigree. And so now when we watch him, we're watching him without those athletic gifts. Those athletic gifts are faded. He still is strong because we know power is the last thing to go. He wasn't a tremendous power puncher, because a lot of that is equated with technique, which he didn't have the greatest technique. And all of a sudden, he's not as fast. His reflexes are more dull. And what I see with a lot of older fighters, and Zito and I talk about this, and I notice this myself when I spar in the gym, we don't bend our legs. Behind him, he was lucky to get a 40-year-old. That's okay. He was lucky to get a 40-year-old Sam Solomon in the ring, whose knee was actually injured before the fight, and then he, you know, injured it again during the fight. So obviously, maybe Peter Quillin knew something that we didn't know, because Jermaine Taylor is also managed by Al Haymon, and so here we go.
You know, it's funny you're saying it, because that's almost exactly word for word what they said in Fight News. Taylor knocking down in the was it the fourth? He knocking down in the fourth. That's where he hurt his leg.
Oh, he knocked the seventh round, I believe.
They were saying, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was the seventh.
Yeah, it was the seventh round. You're right. So he went down to 7, 8, 9, and 11,
mm-hmm.
and they said that it was probably he was heavily hampered towards the end of the fight. So
oh,
you guys got it right on the nose on that one.
You know, it's funny. It was funny watching Miguel Cotto fight Sergio Martinez when it was obvious that Sergio couldn't put any pressure or really plant on his leg. But Sergio's leg wasn't to the point for that fight that Sam Solomon's leg was. Sam Solomon had a very fresh injury to his leg. It wasn't like Sergio's leg, that's what it is. Sam Solomon's leg may be able to heal, may be better, but that night was the night he re-aggravated the injury, and it cost him the fight. To Sam Solomon's credit, he said, hey, the reason why my leg got hurt was because of Jermaine Taylor. I was in the ring with Jermaine Taylor. Gave Jermaine Taylor full credit, but I think also anyone watching that fight knows what happened. And, again, we look at the middleweight champions, and that obviously starts with Gennady Golovkin. Then it goes to Miguel Cotto, and now all of a sudden you have Jermaine Taylor. So I think there's some legitimate-sized middleweights who are licking their chops because all of a sudden they see money that they didn't see. Obviously, Miguel Cotto is a bigger name than even Sergio Martinez. He's definitely a bigger name than Peter Quillen. And Jermaine Taylor's name still carries a little cachet, which is why he was able to get that fight against Sam Solomon without having beat a top-10-ranked opponent in, you know, 6 or 7 years. So
yeah. And now you have – and then I'm doing in the mix after beating Steven.
Who's that, Zito? And Dom, yeah.
And in fact,
and Dom is the mandatory to Jermaine Taylor. And
right.
Lest we forget, Peter Quillen was stripped of his title for refusing to fight Matt Korobov, and it looks like Korobov could very well fight Andy Lee for that vacant title. So what you're looking at is you're looking at Gennady Golovkin, who is clearly the best middleweight out there. But underneath him, you have very beatable guys at middleweight in a Miguel Cotto, Andy Lee or Matt Korobov, and also a Jermaine Taylor. Very beatable guys. And to me, there's a clear between the number one middleweight and then number two, Cotto, and then everyone else to a certain extent.
You know, tonight up at the Sands Casino up in Bethlehem, we've got two of our favorites fighting. Danny Batchelder's fighting, and so is Amir Mansour.
Amir's fights tonight? That's
yeah.
Tonight? On NBC? That's on NBC then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just got the blurb from Russell. By the way, next week, Russell has a program down at the 2300 Arena in South Philly. It's 2300, I think it's Sweatland Street in South Philly. And if anybody's listening, if you you go, you'll be able to see Ty and Zito sitting there as our emissaries. They have been invited to be have press credentials for the fight.
Oh, that's outstanding.
Yeah. On that note, I don't know if our listeners know this, but Stevie Cunningham's daughter was born with a heart defect, and she's been waiting for a heart transplant, and there was a need to raise $25,000 to help defray some of the expenses that the hospital was requesting up front. And Stevie and Libby had sent a note here. They wanted to thank everybody that made their daughter's operation possible. They did reach and exceed the goal, and 90% of it came from people within the fight industry. So we want to send a shout out to everybody that helped out with the family, and we send our prayers that their daughter will come through the operation, and she's going to have it done at University of Pennsylvania. So that's going to be they're a tremendous. That's the Children's Hospital. They're a tremendous heart team. All right, now we talked about a leg going out. Now tell me why Canelo Alvarez is pulling out of the Clady fight because of his ankle that he injured. But the fight's not till December 6th.
Yeah, Clady doesn't buy that.
he certainly doesn't.
But you know, now Canelo's talking about possibly going straight into a Miguel Cotto fight.
Right.
The funny thing is in boxing, whenever there's an injury, there's always speculation. And the reason why is because it's not football where someone's on your schedule. You sign to fight somebody or you start negotiations to fight somebody. So obviously if somebody says, oh, I got hurt, the first thing he says, well, you're scared to fight me. Because you don't have to, you know, it's not a schedule until you sign a contract. I tend to believe that Canelo really did get hurt. He signed with HBO. This would have been one of the fights on his deal. You know, no disrespect to Josh Clady, who I thought at one time was a really marvelous fighter. But this is not a fight at this point in time that Canelo should fear taking. There are certain fights that you say, you know, I don't want to fight this guy because I don't want to mess up the big money with you know, Miguel Cotto. And Josh Clady, you know, in his prime when he was gone, would be that guy that you would not want to necessarily fight big money bout on the line. But Josh Clady's moving up to 154. He's fought there a couple times, and I always thought he could have made 154. But this is a Josh Clady who hasn't fought elite competition since his no-show, quote-unquote, against Manny Pacquiao. And he's only had three or four, you know, a handful of fights at 154. So, I mean, Canelo could view this as a dangerous fight, and, you know, Golden Boy and Oscar could view this as a dangerous fight, especially if Cotto's not fighting and talking about not fighting again until the Canelo rematch. It would make, until the Canelo fight, it kind of would make sense for Canelo to sit on the sidelines. But at the same time, I do not think this is a fight that they were worried about taking. It could just be, you know what, let's just sit on the sidelines since Cotto is. Or he could legitimately be hurt.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that he's probably legitimately hurt. To be honest, who is Josh Clady to duck? I mean, at this very point in time, he's not a guy who you're going to say, well, I don't want to fight him. As you said, he doesn't instill fear right now, especially. Canelo, since the emergence of Canelo, where's Clady been? He hasn't been anywhere.
Exactly.
Around.
Exactly.
So Canelo doesn't even know of him, really. He's not, you know, he's not a guy, major guy on his boulevard. So he's going to, you know, he might just be treating him like that and just say, you know, be fakifying the injury. But I really think that he, you know, he hurt himself. I think he was looking forward to fighting Clady, looking forward to his first fight on HBO. Looking forward to
The last person Clady fought, Clady had a, you know, a wide and dominating decision over Anthony Mundini in Australia, which was, you know, it's credible. It's credible. But at this point in time, Mundine is not even considered a, you know, a top 10 guy at 154. So Clady hasn't earned the title shot. So no one can complain about that fight not being made. In fact, when the fight was, you know, speculated as to being made, most people were complaining that that was a fight that should not be made because Clady hadn't done anything to earn that fight in years. You know, I don't think anyone's crying over this particular brand of spilled milk except Josh Clady.
No. And I would like to see, well, amongst other things, I would like to see Canelo fight Cotto anyway. And I would like to see Josh Clady take some steps to competition before he starts going, reaching up towards title shots and major people.
I agree. I mean, Josh is like 34 now, so he's not as young as he used to be. And, yeah. You know, Josh Clady's a guy that when he fights back, when he lets his hands go, he really is a problem. I sat back and just, you know, not too long ago, rewatched his fight with Miguel Cotto, and Josh Clady lost that fight more than Miguel Cotto. First of all, I thought he won anyway, but I thought he beat Miguel Cotto 115, 113, or, you know, 7 rounds of 5. But, to top it off, there were rounds he gave away just by not moving his hands. Miguel Cotto didn't do anything to him, but you know what? Miguel Cotto's going to get the close rounds. And when Josh Clady didn't let his hands go, those are rounds Miguel Cotto won. But it wasn't that Miguel Cotto took those rounds from Josh so much as Josh Clady took the rounds off. But when he stays in his defense and fights, you know, I'll say this. Josh Clady at his best, is the closest thing we have today to Winky Wright. It's just that we don't see Josh Clowdy at his best enough. He shells up too much.
And the best of Josh Clowdy that we have, I mean, that we've seen, was against Diego Corrales to me. That was the best display of Josh Clowdy. And, I mean, he's very capable. I mean, he's a tough guy, so he's not, you know, a whimper. He's not, you know, punishment, you know, unbearable. But he did it against Margarito. He shelled up. He claimed that he hurt it. He broke his hands or something. But he shelled up most of the fight against Margarito, too. I think it was the pressure. And that, you know, just like against Pacquiao, I think it was the pressure. But
I don't think it was the pressure.
Not when you
get a performance bonus for a fight you threw five punches in for 12 rounds. I find that a little odd. And then also
the
at the same time, when he fought Margarito, that was also Arab's big workhorse in the welterweight division. That was his big guy that he was trying to move in the welterweight division. Clowdy didn't throw. It seems like whenever Clowdy fights one of Arab's big jewels in the welterweight division, he chooses not to throw punches. I don't know. Is it the shoulder? Is it the pressure? Is it the performance bonus? That's my opinion on that one, Zito. I've always felt that way because I've seen Clowdy fight too much. And Pacquiao, when he let his hands go, he was hitting Pacquiao. So there was reason for him to be confident to let his right go. And he chose not to. I don't know.
If that's the case, then that's all the more reason for him not to even fight Canelo, not to even
get if you watch the fight with Antonio Margarito, the first four rounds, man, he was lighting Margarito up. Now, I know Margarito is one who starts slow and builds pressure, but it wasn't a gradual thing. He was lighting Margarito up, and he stopped punching. I wonder if he got a performance bonus for that fight. That's my only question.
I mean, and that's how tough the guy is, because he's like Margarito's a guy that you want to keep, you know, put something on to keep him off of you. So for him to, you know, kind of shell up and selectively punch, you know, that, I mean, that shows toughness, but, if those performance bonuses are the case, then, yeah.
we know he got a performance bonus for the Pacquiao fight. We know that. That's a fact. And I can only speculate for the Margarito fight, being as though the fight kind of followed the exact same course. And out of Clowdy's 37, 38, 39 other fights, only those two kind of followed that specific course. I don't know. Maybe it's a conspiracy theorist in me.
I don't know. He didn't show up against Zab Judah.
Yeah, he let him go against Zab. You know, it could be the moment, too. He could be one of those guys that gets in the moment, kind of freezes up. But like you said, Zito, whatever the case, no one's crying over this brand of spilled milk, because no one really thought he deserved a fight with arguably the third highest earner in boxing of the day. No one thought he deserved that fight. So, I mean, he's less deserving of a Canelo fight than Algieri, to me, is of the Pacquiao fight, because at least Algieri beat Provitnikov. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Boxing is a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately sport, and Josh Clowdy has done nothing for us lately.
Josh Clowdy, he could fight the loser of tonight's fight between Carlos Molina and K-9 Bundridge.
That fight's tonight?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was tonight. I thought ESPN. Damn, I'm off.
ESPN Deportes.
They're
showing Carlos Molina K-9 Bundridge fight on ESPN Deportes.
Yeah, they just had that word come off this afternoon. Doesn't say what time it is. 9:30 Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah. And that fight there.
And you're right, Zito. He needs to fight the loser, and not even the loser. He needs to just fight somebody in the top 10. So.
Yeah, and this fight here should be easy for Carlos Molina, to be honest.
I see Carlos Molina more formidable opponents than a 42-year-old K-9 Bundridge, who was never great with technique. He's a very strong guy, but he's not a very big guy for that division. and again, Carlos Molina's been off for a while, so unless something's changed, he should. I honestly think he should beat I agree with you. He should beat Bungus pretty easy.
Yeah, in a sloppy looking fight, but it'll be clear who the winner is.
Yeah.
Well, we got the Hopkins fight coming up, and now before it's even through the first punch, Stevenson's stepping up and saying Adonis Stevenson says he wants the winner.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I mean, he better hope Bernard Hopkins wins.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't think he wants that, to be honest. But, I mean, he definitely doesn't. I don't think he definitely doesn't want Kovalev to win.
I don't know. It just seems to me Adonis Stevenson has kind of become irrelevant, unfortunately, to the topic because he is the lineal light heavyweight champion. He actually is the linear champion. However, when he kind of reneged on his deal with Kathy in main event to, build and eventually have this fight with Kovalev on HBO, when he bolted to Showtime, I guess thinking he could make a deal with Bernard. Once Bernard made that deal with Kovalev, who is widely considered the most feared light heavyweight, even though Stevenson is considered the number one light heavyweight, the lineal champion, I think in most hardcore boxing scribes and most purist mind, Kovalev is the guy, kind of at 160, even though, like, Cotto's the lineal champion, or I'm sorry, at 175, even though Cotto's the lineal champion at 160, everyone looks at Golovkin as a guy. I think, Kovalev is the guy at 175. And Bernard took the most dangerous fight. Not that Adonis Stevenson couldn't beat Bernard, but Kovalev is a more complete fighter than Adonis Stevenson. So when Adonis left and subsequently struggled with Fonseca and, again, kind of took a deal that put him out of the limelight, this is where he's at. So, of course, he's going to talk now because everyone's talking about Kovalev and Bernard Hopkins. And everyone's talking about the winner of that fight is the best light heavyweight, though in a sense it's not true because of, Adonis Stevenson. But Adonis Stevenson has become kind of the annoying elephant in the room what's actually going on, what's fashionable in the room. He's just become the elephant in the room. And that's not a place he should have been, specifically off of his victory over Chad Dawson. And to me, I think it's a case of his promoter, Yvonne Michel, kind of overthinking the moves a little bit instead of taking what's right in front of him sometimes.
Yeah, his silver lining looked real good after the Tavoris Cloud fight. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, as you said, he's beginning to become more of a third wheel. And there's a show going on around him, and he still has his appeal. I mean, he's still a pretty good fighter. But as you said, Ty, the show's more or less going on to over this way, and he's doing his thing over there. I think that's appropriate, though. I think that's honestly boxing appropriate because I don't think he can handle that type of show. I just don't think Adonis, he's a good fighter, but I think he's really too rudimentary for Bernard. He's a one-handed fighter, for one thing, really.
Yeah.
He doesn't really have a good right hook. He'll throw that. He's a southpaw. He's really, really left dependent. Bernard, fighters like that, Bernard tends to tear apart. Kovalev, he wouldn't be able to keep Kovalev away from him. I mean, I think he could maybe do some things maybe within the first 2 to 3 rounds. But after that, Kovalev seems to figure you out, and I think after that he'll destroy Adonis. So,
it's funny because what you're essentially saying is what I feel about Adonis. Adonis, because of his speed, because of his power, his longer arms than he should for his height, he's the kind of guy who's very capable of catching Kovalev and stopping him, catching Bernard Hopkins and stopping him. But if the fight is 12 rounds, I don't like him in either one of those fights. I only like him if he catches somebody. But outside of that, if he doesn't land his perfect shot, I don't like him in any of those fights, honestly.
And that's the thing. Bernard, he's a master of not being caught by those shots. And Kovalev, you have to catch him before he catches you, essentially, or you have to get him out of there. And he hasn't proven to be get out of there or both. So,
Kovalev is also a two-handed fighter, too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He throws to the body. I like about Kovalev is, you know, something that Bedard has to look at, too, is like Kovalev is not Kelly Pavlik in the sense that, you know, he's a, you know,
one-two
guy
fighter
who has good power.
Yeah.
He's not a one-two fighter. Kovalev mixes it up well. And what Kovalev throws is a very long, hard, straight right to the body, a la Lucas Matysek. And Kovalev is also a natural 175-pound guy. He's a big, you know, he's not coming up in weight. So Kovalev is very formidable. And again, even though he foot-wise may be not as versatile as Adonis Stevenson in the feet, I think he's a much more complete fighter. It poses much more of a threat to Bernard Hopkins over the full course of 12 rounds to me than Adonis did. I think Adonis, if he fought Bernard Hopkins, he would have to get Bernard before Bernard figured him out. If Bernard didn't figure it, come to the ring with him already figured out. Once Bernard got his timing and everything down, I honestly think it's a pretty easy fight for Bernard. Kovalev is dangerous from, you know, from point A to point B. I think that Bernard could be dominating a fight, and then also you could see Kovalev's pressure and his body punch starting to take its toll. Adonis Stevenson doesn't do that. He's lightning in the bottle. Not that it rarely happens, but that's how he strikes. Like, boom, lightning in the bottle. Outside of that, if he doesn't get that lightning in the bottle against Bernard, I think he'd be in deep water. So, again, he's relegated himself to the elephant in the room as opposed to the host of the show, which he should have been.
And I think with Bernard and Kovalev, Bernard has problems with speed. It's simple as that. If you're fast and you're long, and not, you know, more or less fast, that Bernard, he has to deal with that. Kovalev is not fast, so I think Bernard, what Kovalev can do, he boxes from outside. He doesn't generally get body to body with you to fight. He's not that kind of guy. He's not a inside fighting kind of guy. He'll get you at mid to long range. That's where Bernard has to be careful.
Yeah,
that's
what makes Kovalev a little different. Because Pavlik was the same way, but he could only do it with the 1-2. So
exactly.
All Bernard had to do was move to his right, which he did all night long. It's a little different with Kovalev. You can't just move to your right, because then he will hit you with the left hook to the body and to the hand. You know what I mean? So
he can hurt you from range.
Yeah, and where I think Bernard gets all the credit in the world is he has chosen the most formidable opponent he could choose at 50 years old. You know, so again, win or lose, he's a winner. And this is what, you know, something that sometimes greatness is not about winning or losing. Greatness is about challenging yourself, you know?
Yeah, well, shoot. Imagine his legacy if he wins this.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
speaking of Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't care if you look at Yahoo, you look at Fight News, you look at the regular papers, everybody's saying that the big fight is coming in 2015.
That was big this week. That was really a lot of speculation bubbling around that fight. Part of the reason why is because of an interview that Floyd Mayweather Sr. gave, in which he said the fight between Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather Jr. is absolutely going to happen in 2015. A lot of people have been speculating that Floyd has two fights on his contract. People figure that he may fight Pacquiao in the spring and then possibly rematch him if the fight is somewhat competitive, which at this stage of their career probably could be very competitive, but rematch him in November. Here's the thing, though. So everyone heard, you know, the rumors have been bubbling, and then everyone heard Floyd Mayweather Sr. say that, and they figured, oh, man, that's the fight. Well, recently, just a few days later, Floyd Mayweather Jr. comes out with an interview with FightHype.com, and he essentially says that's not true at all. And he said that, obviously, they're changed in the money team, and in regards to his father, changes can still be made. And if his father continues to speak publicly without communicating with him first, you will see his father no longer being part of the money team. He always wants his father. He said he wants his father to continue training him. But they just reconciled, so it's like his father had been training him for a while. But he said that if his father continues publicly without communicating with him that that he will no longer be part of the money team. What people had missed, because he was talking about Khan Mayweather Sr., they also missed him, or talking about Pacquiao Mayweather Sr., they also missed him speak on Americana. That's a fight that he was taking. Floyd says, if I fight Americana, I will beat Americana. And so, obviously, there's also the underground media that is going that way, because a lot of people really feel that that's who Floyd is going to fight. It's just that everyone wants him to fight Pacquiao. So when his father made those comments, everyone ran rampant and didn't listen to the other comments that were made in regards to fighters. But it appears that Floyd Mayweather Jr. was either, you know, extremely offended that his father made those comments without him first addressing that, or he's just offended that his father kind of gave a sneak peek of the negotiations that may be going on. Floyd Mayweather is.
Yeah, well, and this is something you might want to
keep your eyes. The first thing on Yahoo this week was a thing on there, a blurb on there that said that Showtime was pushing this fight to go on. And they had almost, the way it was, I read the thing, they gave him an ultimatum that it happens or else. I don't know.
Yeah, this is something you might want to keep your eye on, because Floyd Mayweather Sr., he feels within himself that he's a grown man, and he's going to say what he wants to say. Nobody's going to put words or direct how he's going to talk to anyone. Floyd Mayweather Jr., these two guys are prideful. They're extremely, extremely prideful. And the only thing that could break up their relationship is pride. Mm-hmm. Just their own pride. Floyd Mayweather, him being the all of money team, basically, he's going to see to it that, you know, nobody strays away, says anything that he doesn't like. You know, he's going to try to have control of that. Well, I knew that, you know, they reconciled and that was good, but that relationship's always volatile.
Always tumultuous, and, always.
Always. And just the fact that Floyd said that, there's changes been made, and that, you know, that a person like Senior, he'll take that as a challenge almost. Nobody's going to tell me what to say, you know. I'm a grown, bleeping man, you know, so.
The other thing, too, is what you say, Showtime supposedly gave Floyd Mayweather an ultimatum. But I really don't know how much weight that ultimatum can carry when Pacquiao has a contract with HBO. So for that fight to come off, one of the two networks is going to have to step back to allow the other network to promote it and to show it. Now, Floyd Mayweather said the only way they would fight, he said this, you know, about a month ago, the only way he and Pacquiao fight would be if it were on Showtime. Well, obviously, HBO is not necessarily going to go for that. So even if Showtime gives Floyd Mayweather an ultimatum, they can only give him an ultimatum to negotiate with Pacquiao. And part of the negotiations would be what company, what network would telecast the fight. And that's something that they can only hope for, but they can't control themselves. So even if both parties want to fight, their fight is still a long way from being done. The last time the networks kind of really conceded was that Mike Tyson Lennox Lewis fight years ago. So you would really see one of the networks need to step back. And, I mean, it's just so much that needs to happen before that fight could be made. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And for a network to step back, it'll have to be a buyout. Showtime will have to actually buy part of Pacquiao out to HBO.
Right.
They have to buy them out. So,
and I think what would probably happen is HBO would probably buy the rights to Floyd Mayweather, being as though he only has a two-fight deal left, you know, only two fights left. I could see maybe HBO trying to pay Showtime for the rights. But again, that's speculating even beyond the fighters' negotiations, because the fighters would have to get past their negotiations before the networks even start negotiating. So
yeah.
It's still a long way off. The Americana fight would be an easy fight to make. And I'm sure Floyd looks at it probably as an easier fight and maybe save Pacquiao for November. But either way, he quickly put a squash to the rumors that he was definitely fighting Pacquiao in 2015. And I believe even if he feels that way, that's not something he wants to, you know, let people know. Floyd rarely lets people know the machinations of his mind until he's ready to make an announcement. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they're going to fight this way. between the two companies because, you know, and I don't know if you guys caught our show on Wednesday night, but we talked about Comcast. You know, Comcast gave the Phillies quite a lot of money last year to help them out. And they can't, first thing they came in was they get rid of the broadcasting group, Sarge and Wheels. And Chris Wheeler has been with the – both of those guys have been with the Phillies since the 60s. Then they went down, and now they want to get rid of Dave Montgomery. They want to get rid of Ruben Amaro. And it's all of a sudden these large companies that buy into contracts – want to start telling sports people how to run their business. So that's a kind of an interesting slant on life here. The other thing I want to ask you guys about was Marco Hauck signing up with the German Boxing Commission because he wants to start promoting his own fights. What do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea.
Oh, go ahead, Zita, please.
Oh, no, I was just saying, what is he signing with the commission to promote? He's trying to get his promoter's license.
Yes, he did get it.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, BDB, commissioner sat down with him. They finished out the paperwork, and now he is a full-fledged member of the BDB. His reasoning was, you know, he's the champ in Germany, and he wants to promote his fights over in Germany, and he thought this was the best way to do it, and that they would have his back 100%. So I guess it's a done deal.
You know, one thing I will say is first of all, Marco Hauck has been a fighting champion, and kudos to any boxer who sees their future outside of boxing. And why should Marco Hauck be any different? You know, especially he's had a tremendous following on the other side of the pond. So,
yeah. The other thing, yeah, we talked to Edner, and we've talked about Belmonte's. And now Belmonte's is coming out and saying that, you know, hey, I'm the opponent here. I'm the guy that's trying to do something with his career, not just Cherry. I know we've talked on Infinitum about Belmonte's, but Ty, what's your thoughts?
Edner's in tough.
Mm-hmm.
Edner's been tough. Belmonte is a quality opponent. Again, it took me a while to realize where Zito and I had seen Belmonte's. And we've seen him lose a decision that he probably should have won to Omar Figueroa. So that's the level he's fighting at. He's fighting at a world-class level. Styles make fights, and he had beaten Figueroa like four out of five times in the amateurs. So maybe that Figueroa's number, but Belmonte is a guy who moves. He doesn't have a lot of power. He moves a lot, puts his punches together well. He's fast, and he throws good combinations. He's a guy that Edner's going to have to be 100% prepared for. He's going to have to keep the pressure off, and he's going to have to cut off the ring. If not, Belmonte's will dance around him and play tag with him all night long, and Edner will have a hard time catching him. So he's really going to have to cut off the ring, put pressure, and apply your strength to Belmonte's.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fight where conditioning is going to be everything. Belmonte's is more than just an opponent. But I'm going to go to what Edner actually said. He said Belmonte's only claim to fame, apparently, is beating Figueroa. Losing the fight that he actually won to Figueroa. He was like, "Who's Figueroa?" Edner's, basically, he's going on his experience and who's he been in the ring with, and that could take care of a lot of stuff. a lot of stuff. He's been in against people who move their feet better than Bamante's, who let their hands go better and faster than Bamante's. So, I mean, Edner, he's well confident with this, and he has very good reason to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about conditioning, though. If Edner has the conditioning, he can take rounds. He can make it look like Bamante's is dancing and throwing those get-off-of-me punches while, you know, he's taking his time, placing his punches, landing the meaningful ones. You know, he doesn't have to necessarily keep up the work rate that Bamante's has, but just make that work rate effective. And I think Dan Birmingham can have him prepared for that.
Yeah, Dan's done a great job with it. Like I said before, I've never seen him this cut or this focused. I mean, he's always focused, but he seems to be even more focused. And I think that being around Keith Thurman and some of the other guys over there, I mean, this was a big change for him to go over there. He had been at a smaller gym over in Orlando before, but Dan has really brought him along. He's got him. He's got him set to move on up, and you know, he's another one that says, you know, hey, give me Pacquiao, give me Mayweather. I'm ready for either one of them. He just wants to get a fight in before the end of the year and have a good time. And I did, by the way, I did go over and see Dan last week, and Keith. They're trying to get a Keith in December 6th. He's going to have a fight, but they don't have an opponent yet. So we'll keep you updated on that as soon as we hear something. Just as a sideline here, Notre Dame just scored 43-36 against North Carolina. So those pregnant pauses. I was off the air cussing like a trooper when they fumbled the ball a couple times. Well, we've got a caller I'm gonna bring in here. Guys, we have a caller online. I think she has something to say to at least one of us. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hi. This is Laura. This is Ty's wife. I actually have a question, and this kind of goes back to what was going on last week when I walked into my house, and Ty was watching some old footage. It was Muhammad Ali. And I walk in the house, and I was watching some, and I just walk in, and I'm watching Ty, and I see him watching some Muhammad Ali footage, and I said, why are you watching this? You know, why are you watching some, you know, Muhammad Ali fight? And he says, well, just, you know, keep watching. So we're watching, and then I am just floored. Because, you know, then he's explaining stuff to me, of course, because he knows technique better than anybody I've ever met. And I was just astonished because the technique is like nothing I've ever seen. Okay, so you guys are talking about Floyd, you guys talk about everybody. But the technique is so impressive, and I just don't see fighters fighting like this anymore. And actually, my question was for Zito. Why do you think that fighters just aren't, they're just not impressive like this anymore? I mean, Muhammad had that, you know, he's a little bit of a show pony, but he also has something to back it up with. Why do you think that fighters just don't fight like this anymore? Why is that?
Well, first I want to say hello, caller. And,
caller! Yeah.
No, that's sister-in-law. Yeah, fighters don't fight like that because, first of all, Ali, before the 3-year hiatus, was probably the most physically gifted, had the best reactions, and probably the fastest guy over 200 pounds that you'll ever meet.
Just to let you guys know, I was watching Muhammad Ali versus Cleveland Williams too. So
yeah, that went up four rounds. I watched that this week too. Went four rounds. He knocked Cleveland Williams down a lot of times.
She saw slipping punches too. She was really
seeing. Now the thing about fighters nowadays. Fighting back then, that was it for a lot of people. That was like it's so much to get into now, to where you have guys that want to play football, or guys who maybe fight part time and then they want to hang out, and, you know, go to the clubs and stuff. To where back then it wasn't a whole lot of that. It was more or less, you know, society was different. Society was a little more homegrown, and so you know, Ali, you know, in those times, you know, these guys they lived boxing. That was it for them. Yeah, they had a job because for support, but even in the jobs they fought boxing. You know, these guys, they might work in a meat house hitting meat, or they might hit, you know, bags of sand or anything, whatever they work with. But they, you know, were always thinking fighting, to where nowadays there's so many distractions, cell phones and TV and computer. I mean, society's different for the average person. So, you know, work habits. These guys will work. I mean, they were work boxers. Everything was, you know, they were living. It was a tougher thing. Now, I'm not saying guys now aren't tough, you know, like that. But when you work on your skill, that's what you are. That's your product. And nowadays, you don't see that dedication to the craft of boxing like that. You're going to see guys strong, fast, you know, hit hard. But you're not going to see guys be able to do all of that and avoid a punch. You're not going to see guys do all of that and take a punch. Within that Ali structure, you had it all. Ali knew he had it all to the point where he could play with you. A guy who also did that was Jack Johnson. If you go back and watch some of Jack Johnson's footage, he played with guys. He would put his hand on guys' foreheads and just rub them in the face, you know, just playing with them. So, I mean, these guys had it down to the fact that they could play. It's like a basketball player knowing that he could cross anybody over. You know, they have that skill, they're going to clown with them. So,
you know what,
I think you have to have that skill.
I think to also answer our astonishingly beautiful caller's question. always try to stay out the doghouse, Butch. But I think also
just
to
say,
answer that
I was
question,
just going
to
say, good night, Mr. Couch. You're back up there.
I think also, too, a lot of it has to do with the trainers. I think there was a brilliance to Angelo Dundee to get a talent like Muhammad Ali and to train him in accord with the fighter that he was capable of being. I think a lot of trainers, you know, train fighters differently. Angelo Dundee wasn't going to train Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray the same way, even though they had some of the same gifts. He wasn't going to train Sugar Ray Leonard and Michael Nunn the same way when he worked with Michael Nunn. One thing, I always thought Emmanuel Stewart, the late Emmanuel Stewart, was a great trainer, but I thought with his style, you could always see his imprint on the fighter. I didn't feel that way with an Angelo Dundee per se. I felt he built the fighter to the best of the fighter's advantages. Muhammad Ali, at that time, was a tall, rangy guy who had phenomenal speed and reflexes. And so he didn't try to make Muhammad Ali fight with his hands up because he knew he could react to the punches better with his hands down because he could see them better. And I think that's a part of it. I think what happens since Muhammad Ali, since the Sugar Ray Leonard days, we have a lot of new trainers who take fighters, they see a fighter who's fast and rangy and say, hey, we want to make you like Muhammad Ali or we want to make you like Tommy Hearns. So I don't think there's as much origination in the training as innovation in the training. I don't think trainers train fighters specific to their skill set. I think they try to adapt the fighter to how they train. I think that's part of the reason to me why you saw some of the struggles with Amir Khan and Virgil Hunter. I don't think he's necessarily trying to adapt Khan's skill set to what Khan already does, but more so trying to say, hey, Khan, you do this, now come do this my way. Not saying that's right or wrong, but I think that was the brilliance of the trainers back in the day and the brilliance of an Angelo Dundee. You're not going to train a Jake LaMotta the way you train a Muhammad Ali. And I think that's that's a little bit of too much what's going on. I think a lot of the trainers are carbon copies. You know, it's kind of like a great football coach who has a great quarterback, but he tells the quarterback, you play this way in this system, and he kind of inhibits the quarterback. I think sometimes that's what trainers do today. And it's because I don't think they can train outside of their comfort zone.
And
well, you know, there's
the
a new there's a new film coming out this week, I Am Ali.
Yeah.
And, it has a lot of the a lot of the old fights in it. It's got a lot of the personal interviews with him prior to his fights. And it really shows exactly what you're saying. His skill, his mindset. He did have the fastest mind. I mean, he could come up with some one-liners that nobody could ever come up with. But he definitely had the attention of everybody, and no matter who, you got to say he was the greatest fighter.
I'll say one thing now, and to allude to another point that my sister-in-law made. Ali, his technique was unique to Ali. Nobody else could do what Ali did. And to be honest, that's if anybody else tried, that would be improper boxing technique. Somebody to sit there and pull their head straight back, No, because if anyone else tried that, they'll get their head knocked off when the guy stepped in and left hooked them. I mean, Ali, he could take the left hook, but for goodness sake, he could stand within inches of you and move his head back because he knows exactly where that punch is going. So
his reflex was within almost like millimeters. It looked like he was, you know, like when you're driving a car, you know your car. It's almost like it's like a glove. You know where you know when it's your car. You know where it stands within that curve. You know where it stands within other cars. It was like when I was watching it, it was like within millimeters of other punches. I mean, you rarely ever see that there's other fighters that I see that now, but just to see a fighter do that so long ago, it was just so impressive. So, I mean, just seeing that, I just was wondering, you know, why? Why then? Why don't you see that so much now? Because the sport is so much more advanced. You would think that you would see that so much more now. You would think that you would see so many more fighters now because we have so, with sports medicine, with so much more sports technology, you know, you would think that you would see so much more, but you don't. You know?
Well, because part of the reason is even though the science behind physical training has improved, the training of boxing fundamentals has actually regressed.
Yeah.
And like Peter was saying, and like I was saying earlier, is part of the strength of Muhammad Ali was his trainer. His trainer knew, you know what, this is not a guy who I'm going to have put his hands up and fight, you know, tall with his hands up behind a jab and shoot the right, a basic 1-2 fighter like a Klitschko, because, you know, Ali with his hands down and his reflexes, Angelo Dundee said, hey, don't change it because you can see the punches better and you can react better and strike better and you can avoid punches better with your hands down because you see them better and you can rely on your reflexes. Well, Ali was truly gifted beyond all recognition. It was when the fact that as he aged and he didn't have those reflexes, he had obviously one of the top 5 chins in heavyweight history. And so he could take a punch and he was still smart and he still had quick hands. But again, I think a big part of that is the trainer. I think Angelo Dundee allowed Muhammad Ali and trained Muhammad Ali to fight in a style that would maximize his gifts as opposed to inhibiting his gifts, which I think a lot of trainers do today. They try to fit a fighter into their mold as opposed to developing the fighter in accord with what's best for the fighter's skill and the fighter's, technique level.
Well, thank you for answering my question. Butch, you're in Florida, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Where are you located?
I'm on the West Coast, 54 miles south of Tampa in Parrish.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we hope to be there someday. So maybe when we come down, we'll visit you, okay?
Got a room right here.
I'd love to do that. All right. Thanks for letting me call in. Maybe I'll do it some more. So, all right. Well, thank you very much for letting me call in.
Before you go, Laura, why don't you give us a plug on your the program that you do?
Okay. My business is Mobile Fitness. It's Mobile Fitness LLC. My website is www.DelawareMobileFitness.com. Ty and I do some boxing training outside the gym. We are actually moving ourselves outside the gym where we're located, so please check us out. We are creating our own gym, and we are looking to franchise, and we are checking out different types of franchises, which may be a boxing franchise, maybe just a regular gym, but Ty is always going to be doing some type of boxing within our gym. So please check us out. We're in Delaware. That's DelawareMobileFitness.com. My number is 233-6133. That is my
area code, baby.
Cell phone number. Huh?
Area code?
Oh, 302-233-6133. Thank you. All right, bye, you guys.
All right, thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Yeah, she gives a plug for her business better than I could. So I forget all the numbers and the website and everything. So.
That's a very good question.
My kids grew up to a great education because of their mother, because the only jeans I ever gave them had Ryder written on them.
But you know what? She's been kind of curious. She walked in, and initially I was watching Sugar Ray Robinson against Gene Fulmer, and I started watching Ali against Cleveland Williams, and she sat down when I was watching Sugar Ray against Fulmer, the second fight where he knocked Fulmer out, and then she continued to watch Ali with me, and she was just kind of blown away by some of the things she's seen. Remember, she trained for a year. She really wanted to take a professional fight, so she trained for a year, and she, you know, knows her stuff, and she know that what she was seeing in those fights of yesteryear, she knows that she wasn't seeing a fight today, and she was really kind of curious about that. So,
I'm glad she had a chance to call in. And anybody wants to call in, we'll open the mic to everybody. If you keep it clean, keep it to the point, we're here for you. There's one last thing I want to do before we go off the air. You know, I've been coaching now for 41 years. 42 years. And today I saw something that I have never seen. A parent who was an assistant coach at a 11 and 12-year-old game come out on the field, start a fight with his own coach in front of his kids, become belligerent. There was a need to arrest the guy. Because not only the assault and battery, but he also made a couple comments that were just inappropriate, and he's probably going to pay for it. But if you're out there and you have you feel that your kid's not playing enough, or you feel that there's a problem on the field, go to the coach and have a heart-to-heart coach talk with him after the game. Not during the game. Don't have the game called. Don't have yourself arrested. Please, when you're out there watching kids' sports, it's for the kids. It's not for you. It's not for me. And let's let the kids play. I'll get off my Phil's Naptobox now. But
hey, good soapbox though. I mean, if we're having our kids play sports to keep them off the streets, then we can't bring the streets to the sports, right? So you're absolutely right, Butch. Good soapbox.
Okay, Ty, you have the honors.
Hey, it was great being on with you guys. I'm sorry I missed you guys last week. My wife and I had a little business to take care of, so it was nice being back this week. Miss Dr. Chris, Bob is our co-pilot. I want to thank Laura Crame and Parquet for calling in, and I will thank her when we get off the phone.
There you go.
I'm horrible.
Good for me.
So we'll see you guys next week.
All right, thanks. Zeke?
It was a wonderful show as usual. We miss Dr. Chris. I want to thank you guys. I want to thank my sister-in-law, Laura, for calling in and asking a very, very relatable, interesting question. These shows are definitely in memory of Bob. And if anyone wants to hear any fighting words, please do call.
You're comfortable calling.
Great. And I want to thank both of you guys. Thank Laura for calling in. That was the question was very good. The technical answer was extremely good. And this is the type of program that we produce, and we love doing it for our fans. We want to thank everybody for listening in. I want to thank you guys for being here each and every week. And it's always a pleasure to sit here and talk with you guys. And it's like going back 30 years ago, sitting on the end of the bench when your dad was coaching, we'd be sitting there talking. So it's always a pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation of men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of Police and Fire Services. When you're out there and you see somebody in uniform, if you just take a minute and say thank you, it means the world to go to everybody on the job. These programs are also dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcat, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Patrolman David Crawford, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Henler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Arnolfo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Barbara Pell, Broward County Sheriff's Office, Chief Al Hogle, Longboat Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township PD, PA Police Department, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, MIT Officer Sean Collier, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Jonathan Scott Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Office, Officer Robert Germain, Windermere, Florida, the Police Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida, Highway Patrol, and Pennsylvania Trooper David Kerr, who was buried this week. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hallow of his hand.
Thank you. Shema Ezahir Ma Son Hashem Nevorat Fet Hakuig Again Ma Ezahir Ma
Shema Lech Ma Yelama Shema Ezahir Ma Son Hashem
Spirit of
County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 has responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul.
Love you. We miss you.